Muskie 360 Podcast, AJ Bird.
Steve!
Steve, what's happening?
Living the dream.
Really?
So, no. It's every day's a waking nightmare. Anyway, you're back on the mend here. I guess you've come back to the living, you know. Danny of the Herbex was kind enough to set in for you last week. He said something about a 3D gerbil prototyping accident. I'm not quite sure. Didn't really
that
get into the details.
Was completely overblown, Steve. It had nothing to do with the attack of the 3D gerbil, okay? Let's just... Well, I was hoping Kevin Van Damme was going to fill in, but, you know, jeez.
Well, I know. I didn't try. Son of Herbeck. I didn't try real hard. That would be awkward. Hey, Kevin, do a Muskie podcast. But anyway, yeah, it's rocking and rolling here. I can't believe we're almost there. We just did the customer appreciation sale at the Muskie shop.
Yep.
That was cool.
Thanks for all the game. Absolutely.
You know, people drop in. They kind of do that every year. We're past the show season, thank goodness. Everyone's gotten their custom colors. If you didn't get them, you're in trouble, Jay. That's what they're saying on the streets.
You'll never succeed ever again without them.
You never. If they were so good, they'd make them all year.
So, anyway, sorry. Show colors.
Nah, I'm just picking there. So now, speaking of shows... And I don't know how many custom cars will be there. It's at least bringing up now because it freaked me out today. I'm looking at, you know, I'm looking at my watch. It's freaking January, or excuse me, March. I feel like it's January. March 23rd. We're going to blink an eye, Jay, and you're 30 days out from Muskie opener in Wisconsin. It sounds shocking, really.
It's crazy because we're still ice fishing around here. Yeah. Well, not me, but you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, we'll see here how quickly this pans out. I mean, who knows what the weather will do, but it's so weird. We've hinted at or touched on it as it goes. It's getting closer and closer, and just the days just tick by. For some reason, the calendar marches forward. It never seems to go backwards. Not yet, unless maybe Dr. Bob's experiment will fix that. But nonetheless, you know, we're marching forward through time here and really need to get our heads around here, you know, because a lot of it, obviously, fishing down here in the South, been at it all year long. You got people opening up, you know, some friends of mine fishing Kincaid, and you got people, you know, fishing Indiana. I heard from a source that water's open in Iowa, you know, and it has been. And it's like, okay. Mm-hmm. We're in it. And if you're a Northwoods guy or a Northern Habitat Zone, because so many, I mean, a lot of people don't understand, the vast majority of these people that fish for these stupid things are, you know, kind of that mid-Illinois and up, and it's here. We're here, Jay. You could count them down, literally. It wouldn't take many marks in your prison cell to scratch it on the wall, realistically, right? You know, or you got your Muskie shop calendar. Maybe, Jay, maybe, just maybe. What month was it where the Muskie and the Eagle are screeching through the sky? It's coming.
Good question.
What month was that?
It's April, baby. It's coming. I'm looking at it right now.
Is it April?
Gosh, that's a photo, man. That is something else.
Look
at that eagle.
Is that actually April? I laughed so hard when I saw that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah, it's coming up in a week.
You're going to feel that way, really, when you hit April. Hold on, let me get here. I'm trying to play catch up here with the old mouse games. I mean, that's what April feels like, really. For those of you that don't have a calendar handy in your car, it's just a Muskie jumping up and an eagle swooping down.
Right. It both looks like they could kill each other. You know, it's rock, paper, scissors, but a little bit different.
Yeah, it's a little 50-50 action there. But, just wrapping your head around that. So if you're not able to wet a line, it's going to be here pronto. Absolutely shocking, which is cool. So let's knock it out. What else we got? The comings and the goings.
Right.
At the Muskie shop. Wow. Okay. Well, there's some there are some things. So I've not seen this guy in person, but I know, Jay, you have this Spanky Bates Violence Topwater.
Yeah. Yeah. It came out this morning.
Gotcha. Yep.
About 12 colors on that thing. That is not a small, wimpy little topwater surface lure.
9.5
Yeah. She's like, yeah, and it's like a 3 ounce steel, so it's going to cast great. Mm-hmm. It's got flashable. Nothing's going to flare out and restrict long casts, you know, if that's what you need. And big head on that thing, flash boot tail, twin trebles. There's a little bit of information that Spanky got us for that, for the write-up, you know, about mm-hmm. the how it works. But, you know, I'm expecting it to be a pretty aggressive plop on that thing, judging from just looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we don't have open water here, so haven't gotten it on the water yet. I don't know anybody that has. Other than the guys at Spanky's, mm-hmm. you know, that tested it. So we'll find out soon enough, but I want to get that thing audibly, you know, I want to get a video on that thing so we can hear it and see what it does. Hey, a lot of people. Yeah. It's looking really good. That is like the hot topwater this year right now. So
interesting. Pretty cool. Yeah. I'm looking at it again, not having it in my hand yet. I'll get one in my greedy paws here before too long, but
well, it's made, I mean, it's Spanky tough. You know, they're very, very well known for super heavy. Yeah, and that solid hard resin kind of construction on the top rotating portion. So
I'm curious
no problem.
About,
that thing's not going to crack or leak.
Yeah, the thing I'm kind of looking at on this deal, because you have the front plop section and you have kind of like a bucktail skirt, right, if you haven't seen these yet. So the plop section reminds me kind of oh, what was that? They make Mr. Twister. They had that kind of forward prop deal there for a while.
The top prop.
Top prop, yeah. Could one theoretically, Jay, for modification's sake, can you take that skirt off? It looks like split rings. These aren't welded rings. I can't really tell mm-hmm. from the picture. So that would be interesting. It looks like there's some things one could do there. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? As far as that, with it being kind of in line, you might see my name pop up at the orders here, because I have an idea for that thing already, Jay.
That's a pretty, I figured that.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, because, and if you don't know what they're saying, because they say about this flex resin, if you've fished the M9, right, which is the M9 is a solid bait. That's that's my favorite flat-sided minnow troll for the last couple years here. And, they're just durable. I was actually changing hooks, believe it or not, Jay, yesterday. It was horrible. So, thankfully, love my BKKs. Had a big old box of them coming from the musky shop of the Spears, right? The BKK Spears.
Yep.
So, I believe they're 25 per box, Jay, right?
Right.
7 boxes later, I quit changing hooks.
Oh, you're nuts. Okay.
No, it was time. I was just like, oh my god, my fingers. I mean, I'm pretty good at it. I do it all the time, but you know, you're coming into this. I seasonally kind of do this spring clean of the boat, right? What I needed in January is definitely not what I need in the boat in March, right? A few exceptions here and there, but
yeah, I get it.
Yeah,
right.
It's kind of that slop over, flop over time for me.
There's always transitions going mm-hmm. on with all your gear. Yeah.
Right, I mean, right.
You've got a lot of storage in there. Right.
Right. And it's just like, okay, I don't need my 13-inch M9 or my, you know, big grandmas and all that stuff. And I don't need X, Y, and Z. I can get rid of the pounders. I can take my curly tail krakens out. Sort of did that. And I was just like, oh my God. The mess of hooks. But it's so important not to get in a lame gear maintenance thing, but it's shocking what will happen, you know, just from your tackle. My gear's outside more than it's inside, and there are some baits, Jay, that I hadn't thrown, you know, like I don't know how many creepers one goes through in a year, right? But I'm always like, everything in my boat, you've seen it, Jay, everything's kind of triplicate, right? Or if not, stored in quads. So I'm not going to have one of something, because I'm a guide. So I need four of something, right? I need three, and then I need a backup. And it's just interesting of like, how quickly, you know, you'll have degradation of split rings and things of that nature just from the weather.
Degradate. So. Okay, that's what I was getting at. I wanted to ask because it's like, were you judging? Were you looking at these things going, just like you're grabbing them one at a time and throwing them the left in a pile because it's like, I'm upgrading this one. I'm going to upgrade this one.
Well, it was,
this one's kind of deteriorating and needs to be changed because I see rust on the split ring or something.
A lot of that. And it's just, you know, with season coming, it's the time to do that. If you're not already fishing, and it's difficult sometimes, at least from my standpoint of somebody that's on the water more days than not. I mean, it's just every day is things slip through the proverbial cracks.
Sure.
And you know, whether you put your, let's say you didn't put your stuff nice and tidy. Like I talked to Steve Herbeck the other day, you know, it was actually a couple months ago, but you know, at the end of the season, he was just done with it. And he left himself a big mess. Right. And it's worth looking at because the biggest thing that I noticed, and I use when I go to redo any baits or I'm switching any baits, it's my primaries are the 5-aught musky op split or musky shop super rings and the 7, right? Or not aught, but they're size 5s and 7s. Seem to be like I can get a few bags of those and those are common fixes. You know what I'm saying? Most baits, the bait might come stock with a 4, but if I put a 5 on the split ring, it ain't going to matter, right? So like a 5 and a 7. And some of these factory components, I mean, it's just, they're ass. Got no other word for it, you know? So
I was just thinking, you mentioned that, I was just thinking that because we got a couple... Just obscure little story here. We got a couple colors of Warhammers in today, which was a Canadian made, and they come without the hooks on there.
Right.
So I take these two colors. It's like, okay, we got two more colors. Okay, not on the website. So I got to photograph them, right, and Photoshop them. But they had to put the split rings on there. So they come with BKKs, and I'm assuming the split rings were BKK.
Were they real flat? So
I hooked them up. Yeah, they're kind of flat. Yeah,
flat,
right?
Flat.
So the BKKs. You know, they're just in a bag. They're not packaged. Yep. You know what I mean? So, and I was just thinking, it's like how many, because I do this all the time. I shoot a lot of the baits or almost all of them, you know, that are on the website at one time or another, or upgrade them and stuff like that. And it's just like you just said, there's a lot of junk out there that comes stock, you know, and you got to be wary of that. You got to really pay attention to this. If you see any split ring with any kind of gap on it, when it's on the bait, Replace it immediately. Oh my gosh. There's a lot of that going on.
I just lived through it and it was hours. I mean, I honest to God, you know, did a quick, but got off the water, quick boat clean, eat some food. And I just put headphones in and just kind of grinded through it, you know, 5 hours of that crap setting there. But you know, maybe it's a little bit over the top and I'm prepping, but it you know, I was saying about like how many creepers do you keep?
It's proper guide maintenance. I mean, you got to do it.
But, you know, one thing I noticed, and this is nothing, the best creeper on the market, in my opinion, I couldn't come up with one better, is the bit and tackle, right? Great creeper. Yeah. So we're not talking about the quality of the bait. I'm talking about I left the bait in storage, exposed to the elements, and I was able to pull one of the tines, the welded tine of the hook off just from rust and pitting. So, and I mean, I was like, oh, crap, it hung on something in the box. I went, so just, you know, that I would rather have to deal with that right hit now, you know, right here and now than, you know, deal with that on a fish, obviously. But at least just to, hey, a friendly reminder on that. And if you see any of that damage, get on it, you know, but just worth looking at. Yeah, and you're saying the BKK rings, this is an aside, just telling you. There are black split rings that come on a bunch of different brands of baits, right? That are notorious. If you have split rings that are already black, check them out because they notoriously deform. You know which ones I'm talking about, Jay. They don't even have a brand. They're just these black split rings. The BKK ones are flat. They're a pretty good split ring, but they're kind of I find them a little bit more pain in the butt to use. You know what I'm saying? I can't grab them with my Xerons as much, but, you know, whatever. Freaking on this hour of Split Ring Talk, Jay, you're right. But it's something so stupid that probably doesn't get enough attention is paying attention to that. Something I thought of too. I'm just going to say it. I appreciate them. A lot of people love them, but I can't do the what is it? The Wolverines that are like triples, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, oh, pain in the butt for me. That's a personal thing. So it's like just going super sevens and overall, but whatever. Check your gear. I just say that as a guide because, you know, maybe you got two tackle boxes. That's way easier than the crap that I just did. But check your gear and just be thorough, especially going into the season here. You know what I'm saying? The other thing, what other gear things happen? You know, good old-fashioned reel explosion this week in the boat. That was great. So, Jay, are you ready for a pro tip?
Your reel blew up.
Not mine. Well, it was mine. I own it. I wasn't using it. But it's always that fun thing, Jay. Just imagine this. After I hear the first kerchunk in the air, right? Mm, by the time I can say, don't stop the bait with the handle, there was no turning the spool anymore. So, oh, God. That was exciting. Oh, boy. Happy that one happened.
It's expensive.
You know, it does. You'll see it come through any day now, Jay. Just watch your inbox. So, oh, man. You know, speaking of expensive, great segue. I don't even think you don't even know where I'm going with it, but you set me up, right? This week for me has probably been the most lost fish I've ever had in a week, Jay.
Oh, that sounds great.
But it's a...
Not
great, but there's lessons to learn. Ooh, right?
A learning experience. Okay.
Ooh, sit down.
Oh,
if you've logged in and if you're using the module for Muskie Continuing Education, Volume 1.4. But I didn't lose them. Right? And that's fine. We're not naming names. I'm not pointing any fingers at, say, the clients.
Dr. Bob.
Bob. But I'm not pointing any fingers
at
clients because everybody's at a different experience level. But it's funny, of things, they all coalesce, they all come together. Right? Putting the absolute finishing touches, Jody Michael is in, believe it or not, the Muskie 360 publishing house right now, Jay. Typing away like a monkey.
Okay. Yep, she's
finishing
good.
Finishing up the editing on the insanity that is, won't tell you the title yet, but the second book is done. The cover is done. We have the test copy done. That's how close we are, right? You're going to get your hands on it here soon. But I had revised. It was so funny doing like with final read through, Jay. It's like you get a prototype bait back, right? And you make the thing and you send it off and you come back. It's like, okay, this is what will be sold in the package. That's what I'm reading of the book, right? And I'm reading it and I have a chapter in there about loss mitigation, basically. It's not called that. It's far more exciting than that. But talking, you know, what we need to be doing. And this week was an exemplification of those scenarios. It was crazy, right? Because here I am coming home in the evening and reading this stuff and then living it on the boat. So coming into season, you know, Minnesota's far, a little bit further behind here, right? Canada's even further. Talk to Glenn, that he's freezing his brains out. Danny's freezing his brains out, right? But it's coming soon for those guys. But Wisconsin, I mean, it is on the tip of the tongue right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing worse than losing a fish. In my opinion, the vast majority of this can be mitigated, right? So let's start at things that happen in Steve's boat, Jay. Cue the music for things that happen in Steve's boat this week.
And after we're done with this segment, we need to go back to alternate and possible names for the new book. So go ahead. Because I have some ideas.
Oh, I have one. That's funny. I've barely talked to Jay, folks. I'm so busy right now, but you read my mind here, because I'll just send you a picture of what I wrote on a test cover. You'll laugh at that.
Okay.
Not for public consumption. But anyway, first and foremost, not pointing any fingers. Everybody learns. I'm not a kicker, screamer, or upset when we lose a fish, but it can be avoided. First and foremost, Jay, committing when we're going into the net. Mm-hmm. Right? We did a video on this. If this is something you need a refresher on before you start hucking and chucking here, there's a netting video on the Muskie Shop. One more aside, just to remind even Jay, because he was sick last week. A lot of people have been asking about videos, and I've actually got a bunch of questions at the app, so I can summarize this. We are working on, and is in the works, basically an instructional series where we're going to take all those videos, we'll put them on the Muskie Shop website under their own tab in some kind of linear fashion as this season wears on, right? So you're not having to pay for this stuff. It's the same information, if not better. And we're going to kind of compile this stuff so you're not looking for it, right? So you don't have to go back 19 months. We'll organize this for everybody so you have it, right? So you got a free little Muskie school we're working on there. Jay Bird's been working on it. I've been working on it. We'll put it together here. So when we're referencing these videos, we'll have them in some way, shape, or form that makes sense as far as a complete program. But if you're worried about netting fish, it's right there. One of the most important things you can do when you have a muskie on, let's say you are with Jay, and Jay, I've hooked a fish, and you're going to net the fish. The number one thing is communication, right? And when it is time to commit to netting that fish, there is no other option. You're doing it, right? You've got to commit. And one of the first losses this week was, I said, are you ready? Put the pressure on the fish. I go to net the thing, and before I can even touch the water, it's on the backside of the boat and jumping because free spool is depressed, right? And I'm not picking, but the guy said, I didn't know if it was going to go in. I was going to get the fish. That's for damn. I don't miss hardly ever. I can think, but that's because people commit, and it's so important when we've got a fish hooked up. If the net man's going for it and we're that close, the proximity to danger, bad things happening, they're at the highest, right? That one went under the boat. He was free spooling on his thumb, just going to blink of an eye. This thing's on the other side. You got the rod, essentially, you got a shield rod bent up under the boat, which now you have no leverage, and poop, hooks give, right? Hook bent out. Fish is flopping and thrashing. Of course he's going to come off, because now that fish is pulling against a stationary point. You know, so there's no way that there's no buffer, no snubber. It's coming off. When you're going to net a fish, or somebody's, whether you're on the rod or you're on the net, there needs to be an audible made that it's happening then. And if that call is made, there is no other option, right? Second guessing costs more muskies than anything. Because say that fish went left or it went right instead of right under the boat, it was still going into, whether it be a live scope pole or it's going into a trolling motor. You've got to commit right then and there. First and foremost. What do you think, Jay? What would you say on that front as far as when it's right there in that moment?
Well, yeah, you got the whole Chinese fire drill going with some people. They get really mm-hmm. excited. You know, we all do. I mean, you know, your blood starts pumping and all that. And sometimes you make, the fish makes a sudden move. All of a sudden it was kind of coming in straight. And it's like, okay, it's coming in, get ready. Then all of a sudden it makes a charge to the left. And that person you said free spooled. Okay, change of plans, you know, wait for it to calm down and where you can get it to, and try to get it to come straight in.
Well, I mean,
that's key. I mean, yeah, the key is knowing when they're super green yet, you know.
Well, the thing in my mm-hmm. mind, not to cut you off, but at that point, if we're going for it, we're going for it. That's what I'm saying, right? If it's going to go to the left,
yeah, I get you.
You're a grown man. You can pull it, right? And that's one of the things that when you're in that scenario and that close to the boat, you have to go, right? You might miss. But don't miss a fish or miss a netting opportunity because you let the fish leverage you out, right? Especially if one's coming straight at you. right? You have head control. And to your point, Jay, if you, I've missed on green fish. Somebody hooks one at 8 or something like that, right? You can have some, some, you don't ever want to stab at a fish, but you can have some missed attempts, or more importantly, and I missed attempt as much as the net man like pulls off on it, right? But it's crucial if you're making that call and somebody says, we're going for it, or pull it in, or pull it its head up, that you make that attempt, right? Because more often than not, what's happening is those fish get leveraged. The shorter that line gets, and something that's lost on a lot of people and caused a lot of grief for me this week, is the fact of hook holes. Hook holes are opening, right? You put pressure on a pierced hole in a muskie's face, it's widening that hole, right? For some reason, that's something you don't hear a lot about. Actually, I talk about in the new book, but you have pierced that fish with a barb, and all the pressure is widening the hole. The where you've penetrated that thing's flesh, you're widening it. Sometimes they're real easy to... You ever notice, Jay, you get one in the net and the hook just falls out?
Sure.
There you go. That's what's happening. So the further out you've hooked that fish, the more pressure you put on that fish, the less mistakes you can make. You can't let them get any leverage and term, which is huge, right? Moving on to other thoughts on how not to lose them, right? When fish jump, the worst thing you can do is pull on them. Happened twice this week, right? Just rocket ships. And it's a rarity. I love nothing more than those just rocket off the bottom or rocket off a structure shots, right? Where they just hit it and they go launching like a monkey in space, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times those eats, if you're running something shallow, like that said, it's gliders, actually Mustang on one of them and a glider on the other. But with those kind of eats, those kind of just this, just rage strike, you know, not rage, but you know, this thing's, he's looking to kill and he's coming with serious force, right? If they're that active, that's how you get some, you know, you get some serious jumping. And just one thing, when you're getting back in the swing, Jay, we got to get back in musky shape here, especially up north. If you have a jumping fish, which happens quite often in shallow water, so you think about season opener, right? You're dealing what, Jay? A lot of times your boat's sitting in five. Where can he go? Where's he going to go? He can't bulldog down to the bottom. They're going to make, you know, lateral runs, and they're going to jump. When a fish jumps, it's so, I mean, I would love to say that I have like the secret sauce to not lose them, right? I can tell you what not to do. I can't necessarily tell you what to do, right? Because in the moment, it happens so fast, the exact of, okay, this works. It's just a game of percentages. So things that don't work on a jumping fish is pulling on them, right? Often.
Right. Trying to pull them in. Not trying to pull them in at that point. Right.
A jump is a, that's a well put, and I didn't think of it that way until you just said that. So when a muskie jumps, you're not trying to gain on them.
Right. You're just applying pressure. Keep the pressure constant.
Constant, but don't add to it, right? So muskie jumps, and like the way you just said it, I think that's probably the way people are conceptualizing, or some are. If a muskie jumps, that is not a time to gain ground. You just maintain, right? So twice I had it this week. Fish jumps almost to the reaction of almost like a secondary hook set, like way too much force. In a jump, the way I do it, and it happens so fast, I try to point my rod at the fish, right? Because at that point, I'm not too far to the left or too far to the right, if that makes any sense. So if he's jumping one way and my rod's kicked off to the other, or he's jumping the other way, I'm not creating too much tension. I kind of feel that surge up. And one thing, if you've caught enough muskies, you will feel it in the line or how that fish is moving when he's about to jump. Right?
Absolutely.
It's hard to articulate if you've never felt it. It's hard to explain. Right? But try to remember that when you have a jumper, there are muskies that just jump way too much. There are some that never jump. And, you know, you might go 3 months not have a single jump. Heck, you can get a whole season. And then you just have, you know, you hit a day where they're all just flipping through the air. The line, you'll feel the best, like I said, the best way I can explain it, it's not perfect, but the best way I can explain it is you feel like you're gaining too much for a second. It's like, whoa, right? The pressure doesn't come off. It changes and you're able to pick up a little bit for a second, right? You're right. You got him. He's kicking around and you feel kind of this shift where if he's going to go off to the side and jump, he'll rise in the water column, right, while moving forward. And it's like, whoa, that you just feel it and you go, oh, he's going to jump, right? You know it's coming. If you've had a muskie on that jumps, there's
a feeling.
You do.
It's weird. Yeah, you do, though. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Quick pulses, too. Sometimes yep. they'll be like a quick, but not like surges and, yep. and you know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's hard to articulate what that feeling is, but they just change. They kind of say he strikes, just for example, muskie strikes on a bucktail. Let's keep it easy. Strikes on a bucktail. You got him coming. You got him coming. He's shaking a little bit to the left, shaking a little bit to the right. Then you'll feel it not run at you, but possibly to the side just for a millisecond. It'll change. And like you said, it's like, blah, 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 blah. It's like thumpy. It's like they're trying to build up steam. I don't know how to put it exactly, but you'll feel it and it rises just for a second. It doesn't get slack, but it changes. You know, it's obviously this fish is changing its height in the water column. So if you haven't felt that, look out for it. If you have felt it, you're going, oh, I know what you mean, but I can't say it either. Right? Split second feels. But be prepared for that because, like I said, trying to put pressure on a fish midair is a recipe for disaster. Right? It just is. Let's go to the other things that have happened in Steve's boat this week. Setting the hook twice. We just don't do that. Right? Older gentlemen, I'm not knocking. These are all teachable moments, right? Swim bait hit on a Mustang, wackety schmackety, muskie's on. Holdover from yesteryear, Jay, hitting them, or yesteryear, hitting them again. Not the best idea, right? And I've seen this debated, and the only time I would ever hit a fish twice, right? Only time I'm going to reset the hook or give them another one. Right, is on really big suckers. Rubber. No, suckers. You know what? You say that as an aside. I don't. Not hardly.
A lot of people do. A lot of people do. Yeah, maybe that's a mistake. I don't know.
Well, the way it's funny, you're talking about the book, and I just went through all this, and I debated literally with Jody like 48 hours ago, kind of on that thought process.
Well, the whole second hook thing is that you're basically generating all this slack line in anticipating the second hook set.
Right. And that's where I'm going. You're doing two things. Let's say we have good hook penetration, right? Take a hook, put it through your cheek, and imagine somebody hits it again. So now we have penetration. Now we've done what we're trying to avoid. We've opened that hole even further. Right. So where we've penetrated the muskie's flesh, that second hook set is not penetration. It's a rip. Right. This week on Steve's boat. Right. That resulted in a hunk of white flesh hanging off of a Mustang. Right. Just pulled it off of him. It's fine. Teachable moment. In my opinion, when it comes to this, with artificials, the only time I will consider it is pounders and like a bobby bait, maybe depending on like if it's winter and I'm fishing, say, a big weighted bobby or a Frankensuic, will I consider it because I'm always worried about teeth getting stuck in wood, right? But with modern braid, modern rods, if you have a good hook set, leave it be. Hit them and be done and keep the pressure applied, right? So when you set that hook the second time, and when it comes to suckers, you know, we're out of sucker time, really, and, you know, it's going to be a minute. But when it comes to sucker hook sets, man, it's in the next book. I just say forget about it. All this turning their head. You know, and I fact-checked myself this year. I have I still have some left, Jay, believe it or not. I couldn't believe they've lived this long. I have, like, the best. Next year, I'll have nothing but dead suckers, because this year I've had, like, no dead lost. Like, I feel like I perfected my tank system. But on that front, right, never once did I consider which way the fish is facing. Never once did I hit them twice. Never once did I second guess. Put your thumb on the spool and blast them and be done with it, right? A buddy of mine that got on a guide trip, got his PB this year as his first sucker hook set. And it was textbook, though. I said, as hard as you can, and then it was done. You know, I think there's a danger in those secondary hook sets, especially when sucker fishing in a vertical manner, right? So there's a vertical nature to this thing. You're applying a lot of force. There's really no buffer or snubber at 10, 12, 15 feet. You know what I'm saying? If you can't set the hooks with 15 feet of line straight down, hit the gym. You know what I'm saying? You've got to hit these fish. But, like, on the flip side, I think with any artificial, any lure at this point, I think it's problematic. I've not seen it pay dividends. You know what I'm saying? Where you go, you get that one hook set. Then after that, I think you're doing more harm than good. And like I said, that happened this week in Steve's boat. Kill me now, right? And the last, Jay, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The last way to lose them here is getting the eat and the eight, right? So there's another eat. Boom. Eat and the eight, right? Fish is okay. On. Trying to wrench them around to the other direction when they're going one direction after a straight out like that. Which, this is a little bit of a figure eight motif, but a good refresher. And again, had a great week. I don't care if we get them in or not. We all had fun. Everybody got to hook up. You know what I'm saying? So I'm not complaining, but it was just relentless teachable moments. Muskie hits in the figure eight, right? Boom. Hooks are in its mouth. Things we should not do. Do not try to turn them the opposite direction than what they're going on such a short leash, right? That's a tremendous amount of force. So a muskie hits, he's going, say, to the right. He hits, and you've set back into him, and now you're trying to turn that fish around, right? The leverage doesn't work. Set back into the fish, and then go their direction, right? A lot of times they're going to kind of freak out right then and there, but I think as muskying, where so many people have learned the trick of setting back into the fish in the figure eight, right? You hear that way more than you ever heard in the past, right? It's kind of especially, and let me qualify that statement by saying, I only set back on fish in the figure eight that are not coming through fast, right? If I'm fishing a moderate to slow pace and I'm coming in the eight and then, you know, I've not had to speed things up, he hits, I'll set back into the fish. If I'm burning blades or really moving with some real speed, I find it be unnecessary and more of a risk, right? But in colder water, early season conditions, fish are not that hot. You got post-spawn fish that are munching. You know, this example, what happened with me was on a rattle trap. You don't have a big bait. You don't have a bunch of mass in that bait. You don't have the strongest hooks. You don't have the weaker split rings. Putting that much pressure and trying to turn that whole fish, because imagine you're trying to turn a 45-inch fish with an 8-10-inch leader. You know what I'm saying? The fish is going one way, and you're trying to turn his whole body with that rod the other way. It's a mm-hmm. tremendous
yeah,
amount.
I get
of,
it. Yeah.
Right, you got opposing forces. His inertia is one way. You're trying to drag him the other way. And you'll see these fish, they'll pop off, and that's what happened. Eventually, you know, he turned it, but it was like, okay, the fish head shakes and it's just off, right? And so being conscientious of these small details is important, because especially, like you said, the early season, you're going to have your jumpers. They're going to run, you know, they're going to be squirrely. These fish are, you know, coming off spawn, or, you know, sometimes they're kind of lethargic, but especially on smaller presentations, they're just drilling and killing. You know, so just refreshers on what not to do, would you?
Yeah, let's say you get one eating on the figure eight on a bucktail.
Mm-hmm.
He eats the bait. What way are the hooks pointed?
Forward.
Out of the mouth.
Out of the mouth. Yep.
Well, yeah. If you reverse the hook set, which can work really well. You know,
right.
if you set the hook against him, you're trying to turn the bait in the mouth to get mm-hmm. it to the hooks to go into it. So, I mean, if you think about it that way, you know, fishing, setting the hook with the way the fish is pointed, you're going to have a better chance of driving the hooks into the mouth.
Yeah, a lot of...
So it's tricky. It's a tricky deal. And my whole thing with small baits, like generally mm-hmm. 5-6 inch length baits or smaller, mm-hmm. a lot of them have really small hooks yes. too. These are light wire hooks. They almost set themselves. These things are sticky yes. sharp. They go in, and if you overdo it, you run the risk of tearing a gap on that tiny little barbed mm-hmm. small wired hook.
Right. And that's the thing, when you're saying that, especially in the eight, you know, to your point on the hook diameter or on the hook shank, you know, size on these things, you know, you're fishing, say, a Buka rattle trap, or you're fishing the Banshee, or you're fishing whatever, right, of number five bucktail. You know, those are, like yeah. you said, smaller hooks. You wrench on that, it's easier to fall out. It's not a big bar, because if you lose pressure on a fish, guys, if you look at what a hook is supposed to do, so it goes in and the barb is supposed to keep it from falling out. It's what the barb does. That's why if when you stick it, you know, you hook yourself or you get it stuck in your shoe, if it's past the barb, it's hard to get out. Simple, period. That's it, right? But if you pull on it and you open the hole, right, where you've put the hook, it comes out easier. So you've got to really balance pressure and think about, A, what size hooks you have on, what caliber of fish it is, and are you at that in any given moment? I mean, you got to think, you're subdividing, Jace. These thoughts are subdivisions of an event that might last 30 seconds, right? So in 30 seconds, you have to make, either you got to get lucky and it goes your way, or you have to make multiple decisions instantly on what you're going to do. And that almost goes into like fighting fish. Again, I'm not trying to shill a book here, but my brain's in it right now. And there's a chapter on that of how I fight fish, which is it's a battle. It's a, you know, you're fighting a fish, right? Whatever you want to call it. But, you know, that fish's gig, that muskie is trying to, It's trying to get away. It doesn't know what it's getting away from. It just knows it doesn't like the stimuli it's receiving right now, right? It knows which direction that stimuli is coming from, which is wherever the pressure's coming from, which is you, right? And hard movements, you know, you've got to realize, like, if a muskie makes a hard, powerful run, if you're wrenching back on that fish, right, you got a 50 on, boom, and you're pressuring the crap out of him on one movement, one lateral movement, say it's going to the right, and you're leaning back into him, you might be able to accommodate one of those in a fight, one big run. Let's say this fish has some gas in the tank. He goes the other way. Well, you've opened that hole up. You've exposed any weak links in your fishing setup. But the longer duration, now you see a lot of guys that are just trying to get it over with as quick as possible, which has its merits. But their strategy, like I said, in that 30-second interval from you've hooked this fish, now you want to get him in the net, there's, like I said, there's multiple failure points in their all split decisions that you need to think about. What am I going to do if, right? What am I going to do if he jumps? What am I going to do if this fish tries to go straight down? Am I wrenching him up? Am I letting him go down? Am I taking pressure off, right? Which is something that I do that I don't know a lot of people do. I'm not saying I'm doing anything special. I just know it's not as common as just like wrenching them in. Where when I have a really big fish on, it's not uncommon for me to go into free spool under serious tension. Say that fish is going to try to bulldog down straight down, right? All I can think about is a fish that's bulldogging down vertically is maximum stressor to all of my gear. Right, maximum stressor on split rings, maximum stressor on hooks, maximum stressor on that penetration point. And so I'm picking my punches, and like I said, it's something to think about. How do you intend to fight a fish? What what are you going to do with all those variables and all those scenarios that can play out? Not just a jump, but, you know, just the overall scenario of that, much less preparedness. You know, I didn't know we were going down this rabbit hole. Didn't mean to, per se. But, you know, you're gearing up, Jay. We're getting ready to hit her again. You know what I'm saying? You guys start thinking this way. Wozers. Something else, Jay.
For sure.
I'm rambling on here. I'm looking, and I the screen's still pulled up here. We got so just dialed in on the Spanky Bates violence. Forgot to mention, looks like he got some tallywhackers back in.
Oh, so, yeah, we did.
Yeah,
we
I just saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, relative of the Gooch family, yeah. A cousin. Good. So he's taking them. Super nice guy.
Wonderful.
Yeah, they're back in stock. All the original stuff. So yeah.
If you don't know the
long lost legend.
Yeah, the Randy, the maker of that, had passed away. God rest his soul. And we're glad to see that. Like, I'm glad to, you know, you're telling me that in real time. I know Tom had kind of heard that might be going down, but that's good. This is, again, Gooch Tallywhacker. If you ain't caught one on a Gooch, you ain't musky fishing.
it's a classic.
It's an OG, and it's worth having. What else did I see that we looked at? Renee's baits, crazy little.
Yeah, the livid fish. Yep, yeah. Got those back in. Yep.
Old school. Who's making those? Moses?
Nays Bates. Corey Nays. Yeah.
We're going back. I feel like, folks, welcome to the 1986 episode of the Musky 360 podcast. We got hot new baits, Gooch's Tallywhacker, and Nays. I'm teasing. Folks, get yourself on a Boo Garcia 6500.
Exactly. We got Banshees, Jay, coming in any day now, too.
On that front, though, is down scan cheating? Sorry, going back, we need to do that. We should just go back and have the 1985 episode of the show. All these people driving around with their flashers. No, yep. That's cool. Nays Bates. Once again, it's funny. It's like that. Those have been around for a hot minute, but they catch muskies. You know, I always looked at that bait. I have them hanging up. Haven't used them in a minute, and it's always fun when I see stuff kind of come back in stock, or we mention it, where Nays baits for me, because they dive so deep, right? 20, 25, if I'm right. Let me look here. Do you have a dive depth on there? Boom, hold on. Yep, they're saying 25 on that one.
Okay.
Except making sure they didn't change it. But this was kind of back in the day for me, one of the first things that I felt like I could expand from, like, a lot of the lessons from, like, spoon plugging with, which is the old, if you don't know, folks, people rotate in, people rotate out on the podcast here as far as listeners, but that goes back to Buck Perry, which is kind of the Prometheus of structure fishing. And Buck Perry invented a bait called a spoon plug. It is a metal piece of metal. It is a metal plug with a couple two-prong hooks on there that basically his thought process was, the presentation didn't necessarily matter as long as we're getting close enough to the fish. Still holds true, I'm thinking. But Nays baits for trolling is a pretty interesting trolling bait, where I've done really well with those way back in the way back machine, dragging them on bottom. They're pretty reflective. Jay, you ever fish them at all?
They're tough as nails, and they got a really good wobble. No, I haven't really fished them. I've seen them. So, but yeah, he sent some pictures over. There's some giant fish caught those things. Out in trolling country out east and stuff. Yeah, especially
last fish. I was trying to think, and maybe it's not the last, but close to last fish time I ever caught a fish on a Nays bait was in really heavy current. And I don't know if you want to call it trolling or not, but I'm anchored. And this is not spot locked, anchored, right? And just holding that thing and feeding it down current.
Letting it hold.
That's funny. If you look back, there's all these old techniques and things that you know, are lost to time. You know, here we're on the Wayback Machine. But setting stationary, like let's say we're in current in a serious river, right? You can read the water pretty easily in a river by seeing, you know, the flow of the water, and you'll see pockets and holes. It is a pretty good maneuver by anchoring, like I said, in the current and feeding baits into pockets and holes upstream. That's old school, but it still works, right? Another thing that most people never do, and you have to go back, and I've got here the Musky 360 library, Jay. It's very, very close to the publishing house, right? But our library, Jay, it's like the Jedi library on Coruscant for all you Star Wars fans. But, you know, it's replete with Musky books. But one thing I always loved, and I've stolen from it, and I can't remember who wrote the book, was fishing rivers from the bank and using planer boards, which was ridiculously cool. Where,
okay. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I subsequently have read up on that, and that was old school for salmon fishing, but it's still doable, right? So I haven't done it in a while. I have done it, and it's pretty dang cool because you'll always see this thing, like if it's an inaccessible area. So lay this on you. Some dam faces, right, you can't access by boat, right, Jay? Can't do it. Not allowed. Yeah. You got barriers or whatever you might have, but you can bank fish above them, right? Well, bank fishing for muskies, well, you go, that sucks, but I'm not in my boat. You will find times where there's a tremendous amount of fish below impoundments, you know, different size river and all this stuff, where you can take a planer board. Now, a trick with this is you want to tie an additional line to the planer board after a strike, right? So you want to have like a small nylon rope or something like that to retrieve your planer board. But feeding planer boards out with the current to get around like wing walls and things of that nature, and holding, essentially you're trolling from the bank, right? You're just holding baits in place and moving them left to right by using the trolling board, which is kind of cool. But old school thoughts, you know, down the rabbit hole on that. Let's hit a couple Q&A. I did not know I'd ramble that long, Jay. Sorry. Was that the longest riveting split ring dissertation you've ever heard?
We really hours. Didn't cover the whole split ring story. There's much more to get dive into next week.
Split rings, episode
split
4.
Ring colors and why they work.
Are you dialed in on flat nickel? Anyway,
split ring. Are you using, yeah, black nickel or painted black rough matte? The difference is astounding.
Astounding.
Are okay, even, that's enough of that.
Yeah, are you even trying?
Are you even trying?
Oh, okay. So this is kind of a specific bait question. And I don't think it's a bad one. So we're not picking on any bait. Jonathan, I just received a Tyrant Dictator from the Musky Shop, but it seems to be untuned. How can I tune it correctly? Dictator. Is that their tail prop?
Dictator's the creeper style.
Okay.
Those are tough.
Okay.
Creepers are tough to tune when they come unwhacked. Yeah.
Moving on. I'm teasing. Yeah, they are. Okay. So do I have one of these? Let me look. Creeper here in the bait cave. Let me, because it looks close enough. Give me a second here. Jay Hum. No dead
air. Yeah, one of the things with creepers is if it's just slightly off, you can do small increments on the wings. But generally, if it's not running, if it's not catching the resistance of the water, you want to spread them out wider until they both kick, and then fine tune it from there. It's not easy, guys. That's why guys quit making creepers that it did for years. It's just like they spend an hour tuning each one before they put it in the packaging and sell it.
So this is not a dictator. I actually don't have one. But with your different creepers here, right? Just want to make sure I have it in my hand because it's a little bit more complex than turning a tail prop. So it's going to be about your angle bend. So I have a creeper here in my hand, and I'm looking at it dead center on, and it is properly tuned. Now, with the bit, it's funny we mentioned creepers. I didn't know this question was coming. Never do. But the bit and tackle, and I've not had them come untuned, really. You know, I think he's using like a tempered metal, who knows. But with your creeper style baits, it's important, in my opinion, that the blades, like, let's call them wings or blades, right? You have the two arms on either side, that the angles are similar on either side, right? You'll get them if, let's say, one's not, you don't want them bent out entirely, right? But you want them even, because you end up with, if you end up with a lopsided lope to this bait, often at times you'll end up with, say, the left wing is not working, right? So I want to have even, I want symmetry in the bends, right? I like to start conservative when I'm retuning one, because remember, and I was looking for them, there's just so many freaking baits back here. The high fins, Jay, remember those? The high fin creeper?
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, had to tune those. You know, you bang them off a rock or you get a muskie in the net. We had to rework those. So what I'm doing is starting with incremental change, which is super important. So we don't want them bent all the way back and they're like sticking out at 90 degree angles from the side, right?
That's too much, right?
Too much. Start with, you know, what, 30 degrees, you know, whatever, tighter to the body. And then we're going to tune them and find symmetry, right? So if you have one that's been a little bit too far back and one that's a little tighter to the body, you're going to get weird lopes, and that's going to cause one of them to not be able to open, right? Because if you remove the wings from a creeper, essentially you just have this flat body that really doesn't do anything. So as much as it is important as for one wing to dig in, it allows that body to kind of kick back and open the other wing, right? And bending those is important. So start with incremental bends. Sometimes, and I've seen creepers do this, especially after a catch, right? If you can imagine, we got a muskie in the net with this thing and it bent the wing back a bunch.
They get bent up in the net, uh-huh, for sure. That happens a lot.
What you got to do is take, not essential, but you got to take that wing and lay it back against the body, right? And you'll have the counter part of that wing. So the wing has essentially a stopper on the very bottom that keeps it from going back too far, right? Sometimes that gets bent way too much, or it gets bent inward where it can go back way too far, or it's in too tight. So you need to take a pair of pliers, right, and bend that. And that's going to help you for over bends and under bends. So you're essentially tuning behind where that's joined, right? So we need to tune from there and use those stoppers or those extruded pieces on the creeper to tune that in. Like I said, small bends, small incremental change, look for symmetry. That's the number one thing you can do. Tuning a creeper is definitely, in my opinion, an on-the-water endeavor, right? That's an on-the-water thing. You're not going to, I mean, you can get it, you can get symmetry, you know, at the house, you know, but you need to make a short little bop cast and watch the lope, right? And it just depends on how the bank's constructed. I will say this, that I have had creepers, excuse me, in the past that could use a little bit of tuning on the hook hangers, right? Mm-hmm. That'll throw it out of whack. So make sure your hook hangers are symmetrical. Your front and back are in line with one another. And keep that line, like the line attachment, square, right? If your creeper doesn't have it, just put a freaking big number 7 split ring on the front of that thing too. It'll help alleviate. It's just like, this is just like tuning a Suic. I hate doing it, you know, but I'm damn good at it. And the first thing I'm going to do with any of them is put a big split ring on it, right? So any bait that you're tuning, and that's, heck, we'll just go old school on the rest of it. Tuning baits, period. Crank baits, this guy's creeper problem, you got a Suic, you got a bobby bait. Less is always more. Always is and always will be, right? Don't go and just bend the tail of a Suic over all the way and go, well, it's not running, or bend it all the, you know, incremental change, because the hydrodynamics of stuff is tricky. You know, that's why everybody and their brother, I make musky baits. Everybody makes musky baits, right? My neighbor makes musky baits. His uncle makes whatever, right? They all do. And you, there, the magic is in the details. The devil's in the details on this stuff. So incremental change when tuning is key. You know, with the creeper deal, just keep schwacking away at it. You know, get it, get that walking ordeal gun there. But like I said, with all these other baits, and it's going to be a lost art before too long, Jay. I mean, wood production's just not. Wood production's not kicking up too heavy, you know, in mass.
No, of course not. Right.
And, you know, it'll be a thing of the past. You know, good. I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. It's just a thing. But, you know, you get a lot more consistency out of your mass-produced products now. But definitely, I think everybody's kind of got a handful of older stuff laying around. You know, goes to your gliders, which is, you know, say you're trying to tune a Phantom, making sure everything's in alignment. First and foremost, you know, that's again important. And then let's say we're trying to get a good left to right glide on a bait. Small changes. I'm talking 16th of an inch can make all the difference, right? Just the tiniest little turn will do that. One other thing that popped in my head here. Let's say, Jay, you just got some musky baits. You don't have a tremendous amount of experience on the water of what they should look like or sound like, right? This mm-hmm. is a perfect utilization of a platform like YouTube, right? Now, do not go and here's Larry, no offensive to somebody's channel, Larry's Piking Adventures, right? And Larry doesn't know what he's talking about. And he's got a Phantom that runs like dog crap, right? Try to find like good foundational material. That's overarching. I'm preaching today. I don't know what's wrong with me. But I find that is critical, excuse me, in musky fishing, period, right? Is really being cognizant of where you're getting your information, right? Because we do live in an era of, and it's a positive, it allows us to do shows like this where there's a tremendous amount of voices, right?
That's overstimulation,
right? Overstimulation, but that's better than the day of the gatekeepers where, you know, a guy like me from the South, no, you know, wouldn't have a voice. You know, if you're not right there in freaking central Wisconsin, who are you? You look at the legends of the sport, it's hilarious. They all happen to be from Wisconsin, right? Wonder why, right? That was the hub. But, so I'm not saying more voices is good, more voices is bad. It's different. But that is one of the shortcomings or one of the downfalls of modern musky angling is you need to be aware of sources, especially when it comes on how to run a bait, right? And obviously my brain's going here because we're talking about tuning a bait because I have watched videos and you're like, that's not how that's supposed to look, right? Or that's not kind of, and there's room for doing it different, don't get me wrong, but you know, there's foundational or fundamental skills that I think that get lost in the modern era with social media. Too much inundation or too many opinions where you go, I don't know. That's worked for 30 years. I wouldn't change it, right? But I say that when you look at, say, trying to find how a bait should run. That's what I think. And Jay, you know, kudos to Jay. Clap, 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 clap. Everybody watches, you know, all those underwater demos you do at the shop. Because that's a pretty good example of what the bait looks like underwater. But that's also a pretty solid foundation of you're going generally, Jay, here's the baseline retrieve, right? You got Tom, you got you. Here's the basics of the bait, right? Those are good examples of what it should kind of look like. Glenn McDonald 54 or Bust does some underwater stuff that's superlative on that front.
Yeah.
I would say other stuff on retrieves or tuning baits. That's when I like to really pay attention to like manufacturer stuff. Tyrant Tackle, for this example, I don't know if they have anything. They may not. But, you know, that's when I start really looking for foundation or make sure you're getting that from the right sources so you're not going down the rabbit hole. And I say that, I'm not knocking anything. But, you know, I mean, it's just like I kind of – the idea for the Titan was from freaking writing an article on tuning Suics because there was a million people had written an article on how to tune a Suic and most of it was kind of garbage. You know, then I went, why are so many people reading this? Because they have that problem. But from that front, like I said, just be cognizant of that. And I think that's overarching now, Jay. I'm not trying to make social commentary by any stance, but my goodness, you got more information and more garbage out there than ever on any subject you want. Have you ever just messed your algorithm up, Jay? Have you ever just decided to just trash your own day by watching one flat earther video, and now your algorithm is just screwed?
Oh, I see what you're saying. You know? Yeah, it happens pretty easy.
You can go down the rabbit hole of bad ideas fast, and
all it takes is one mistake.
Oh, I watched a video.
You're messed up.
And I don't say this. I'm not saying, when I say this about informational sources, you know, it's funny. I'm not saying just musky. I'm not saying there's good, there's bad. Everybody has their place, and everybody should have a voice. That's great. But I saw a bass video the other day, Jay, popped up. And it was essentially just that structure didn't matter, which was a flat earth moment for me. Like, no, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, dude.
Did you watch that video I sent you, that Randy Blockhout video on what bass fishing used to be?
No, I was so slammed.
It's very interesting. Funny. He did a really, really good job. It's very eye-opening to me.
But I just say that just from, you know, when everybody's gathering information or you're researching or you're thinking about this stuff, to be considerate of that now, even in fishing, because that was a real Fonzie jump in the shark moment for me this week of seeing that. And I'm like, I don't know about that, homeboy, right? I don't know about that. So it's just worth considering. Goodness gracious. What else do we got here? Try to zoom through them here. Trenton, musky fishing beginner in Southwest Michigan. Getting geared up for spring musky as we've got a few lakes down here that are stocked annually. Apart from lunar data, targeting shallow areas containing bait fish using small lures, is there anything else I should be thinking about when it comes to fishing these downstate muskies? Just an added black meat grind. Oh, added a black meat grinder and a Titan. Cool. Early season muskies, you know, he's looking at the SOAR lunar data, targeting shallow areas containing bait fish. It's going to play. It's just a truism of this fact, which is be looking at those north facing shorelines, right? Or the south facing shorelines, get that north sun in the beginning of the year because it's going to be the warmest water. Post spawn muskies notoriously want to be in that warmer water. Kevin got two banshees. They're incredible. What I want to know is how do you work them to get the side and side action I saw in the video? I'm using in that clip of, if you go, it's the promo video we did for the shop. I'm using slackline twitches in that. And you can also, and it's pretty dang pronounced, is start using reel turns as well, right? So I find it easier. It depends on what mood I'm in. Is using reel turns is very consistent. Not a full turn, but throw the bait out depending on your speed of reel, right? So I'm using 5.8 to 1 tranks. So using about a 3/4 turn gets it to go one way and the same distance. So you need consistency in how much of that handle you're turning, right? So get a pace. Try half, 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 like half turn, half turn, half turn, half turn. Or maybe it's 3/4, maybe it's full turn, dependent. Watch how the bait reacts and find that sweet spot where you go, okay, it's a half turn on my reel. And it goes left, right, left, right, left, right. And you can get that going pretty good, right? The half turn or the partial turn of the reel creates a little bit of slack as well because you're not hammering on the bait. So it needs a tick of slack in there. Like I said, some days if I'm feeling squirrely, I'm using slackline twitches and get that. My tip to you, get that out in the water, throw it out, you know, and watch it and find what feels easiest for you. A lot of times for clients, for me, it's half turns or partial turns, you know, and I'm mixing it up. It's like I said, with that bait, and Jay, you said they're coming. They were supposed to be there, folks. I don't know if anybody noticed the TSA. Did they go on strike, Jay? What happened there?
I don't know what's going on there. Yeah,
it screwed the old.
I believe they're en route. So
it screwed the old FedEx up. I can tell you that because they couldn't get drivers. So have fun with that. Thanks. Wonderful. You know. But long story short, get that bait in your hand once they restock, and he's already got them. Try partial handle turns. Try slackline twitches. You'll get the left to right once you find how much pull it takes, right? Meaning forward momentum, it'll go left to right on it. Brennan, do you think trolling is a waste of time now that people can live scope open water? No, I don't. Without going down the rabbit hole of all rabbit holes, because I've already been there today. So, on scope, live scoping open water. People do this. They sharpshoot. It's fine. Whatever. Right? Going out and finding a fish that's suspended in an open basin does happen, can happen. You can do it. Anybody can do it. Those are fish that traditionally you would catch trolling, right? That is a different bite than muskie that are holding tight to deep structure that are unexposed, right? So I've had other people ask me about this. So we have, you know, you'd always read an article, Jay, suspendos, right? People say the old suspendos or suspended muskies.
They do all the time, right.
Mm-hmm. So a fish that say more, let's qualify this as well. We're getting away from the shallow edges and we're out in the main basin where there is deep structure, possibly deep cover, and then obviously a empty water column from the bottom to the top. There are muskies, and there are more muskies that are tight to bottom structure, tight to deep water cover, right? At this current juncture, they're not the easiest to go, oh, there they are in scope. Right, that's not the same as a muskie just showing up as a big blob or a big silhouette on your live scope out in an open basin. Different bites, right? Long before live scope, I target open water. Actually, in next level, I talk about how I'd work in a grid-like fashion and work blah 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 blah. This is pre-scope techniques. These still apply because these fish, these suspended fish that people will target in open basins often are just coming off, or maybe they're just in a restful state, maybe they're staging, but there's a lot of fish that are using deep structure, possibly, potentially, if available, deep cover and structure that you can target with deep trawling applications. You know, that 15 to 20 feet deep stuff where, you know, a Smitty lunge deep, a reef digger, things of that nature, they're still applicable. I don't find that those open water fish that people will snipe are the same populace, right? They're just not. I've caught those trolling fish, and then, you know, it's a different animal, not a different animal, but it's a different, how would I put it? It's just different staging. Where, okay, you have your shoreline fish, you have your mid-cover and structure fish, you have your deep structure, and then you have these basin fish or the deeper stuff, and then people will see them suspended. I don't think that scope replaces that. I don't think it eliminates trolling as a tactic over open water, because a lot of times it's the chicken or the egg, right? Well, they're all suspended. Well, did you see them all, or is that fish just one, you know what I'm saying, that came off the bottom? So, different animal there. I don't think that trolling has lost its relevancy at all. I think it's actually, I'll tell you what, I think it's actually more important than ever in the era of live scope, right? Because one thing that, and I like I said, I'm agnostic on the topic. You know, you go scope and you don't, however you do it. Right, I got scope on my boat. Everybody knows that I use it for follows, figure eights, and structure, whatever. But that fish that is just sitting in an open basin, in an open water, suspended at whatever depth it might be, you know, it's a different engagement on that fish when something comes up from behind it. It's on a planer board, right, opposed to getting bombs dropped on its head. Right, different engagement. And I think trolling is relevant, especially if people are out doing that. I think it now makes you stand out from the pack. There's lakes up in Minnesota that, you know, by the end of last season, everybody's, well, all they do is scope. Okay. Well, you know, if you don't want to join them, beat them. You know, they always say, if you can't beat them, join them. I think there's an opportunity that you can, instead of joining them, you can beat them by completely standing out with. Think about this. You have a technique that is tried and true. You have a tremendous amount of tools for accomplishing said technique and hardly anybody doing it in open basins because so many people are fixated on scoping. Meh. Interesting, right? You can send boards out. You can do some things that others can't. So I don't think it's lost its relevancy at all. I think that trolling in basins or open water is always going to be a part of it. Maybe I'm wrong. Spencer got absolutely crushed on a menace this past weekend. I was working it like a tube, but a bit softer. Good. When you work them, how do you figure eight them? I got two low 40s this past weekend, but I had a follow. I couldn't convert boat side with that bait. Okay. Well, Jay, I'm in the hot seat here. You haven't had a chance to really huck and chuck one of those yet. When I'm working that bait in a tube-like fashion, like he said, he's working it softer. So it's to get the same running depth as, say, a Kraken or Red October, I'm less energy, right? Less hard. I'm not hitting it as hard. Check, right? When I'm getting into that last third, last quarter, however you want to break down your cast, when I'm getting that last bit, I'm actually going to side sweeps, more of a pull pause thing, right? With a little bit more line out and converting that way, right? So transitioning to a pull pause and then your standard jerking around the boat like a bulldog or a Medusa in the figure eight. I have converted fish dead sticking it and doing the low water pop like you would do when you're figure eighting a tube, you know, with extra length out. But, you know, if I'm getting them coming in that close and they're just not grabbing that thing, I feel like the transition to a different retrieve style, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
More important, right? So,
sure.
Is it a trigger? Are we changing it up and getting the eat, or is this a little bit more of a controlled methodology? Both, right? Because I always think a bait looks, you know, baits get anemic at the rod tip. And like I said, with the menace, you can do it like a tube. But like I said, I like to rip it. If I got a 12-inch leader on, I might leave out an extra 6 inches to or a foot. So I got a little bit more lope in it. And like a jerkbait style figure eight. But I keep that going. John, looking for help building bucktails. I bought a tremendous amount of parts. This is funny. Oh, goodness. I bought a tremendous amount of parts and pieces, but every one I build is awful. I've been there. They won't start when I've gone and test them on my local waters. I seem to only get the blades going at extremely high speeds. I sent a photo. What am I doing wrong? Hold on. Let me try to pull the photo up here. Buddy, we've all been there, Jay. It doesn't happen. Nobody builds their first bucktail and is an expert. Let's start there. And the one thing, okay, I got the photo there. It's loading. The one thing I can tell you, the cool thing about bucktails, if you built them wrong, guess what you lost? The time and the piece of wire you tied them on. That's about it.
Cut the wire, save the pieces, start over.
You get to rebuild your life, folks, for just $9.99 a month. Call now. Looking at it, here's the culprit. We don't have enough space between the skirts and the blades.
Yep.
So,
what about the gap between the tie end and where the beads start? Is there enough?
There's plenty there. Yeah, we got
too much. There's plenty there. Okay.
So, basic core. Actually, speaking of reason we need this, have a video at the Musky Shop on the YouTube on building bucktails. I'm kind of a, you know, bush fix redneck bucktail maker. Let's just put it simply, right? Bucktails are the least precious thing in my boat. I don't carry around a box full of bucktails. I carry around a Plano flat full of parts and a plastic bag full of skirts, right? You don't have to be fancy making these things. Muskies don't care. But let's talk about the foundation, one of the key things that do matter when you're making them. Space enough between the bottom of your blade and your skirting material. Take that skirting material. He's using flashable. I don't care what you're using. Have a gap between the high part of that skirt, right? So wherever the top of that skirting material is, if you pull it back as if we're in the water, right? If that skirt is forward momentum, it is wet, right? So just pull it down in your hand and hold it vertically. Give yourself like one finger's width between that. That'll solve a lot of your problems. Those blades need space to start. Flashaboo skirts, rubber core skirts, notoriously will kind of puff out around that, and the blades hit the skirt. They never really get an opportunity to start going, right? Spacing there. You got all those beads, whether they be brass beads or hollow core beads, just space them out, and you'll realize what your typical, I just need to leave that. It's my skirt and it's three beads, and then my lure body, and then my other beads in my clevis, right?
Right. Bare minimum, there should be probably at least three beads in a body. A standard body length is what, about an inch and a quarter, or something like that?
Yeah.
Something in that range to get the minimum gap there.
And if you don't know, a lure body, there's metal. They're usually brass, and they can be lead. They're the cylindrical weight on the front of a bucktail would come a lure body. But you said, and something I've seen people do a lot, is they don't have enough space at the top where it's like literally like they've got wire right against the clevis. You need room to breathe, right? Don't tie it too tight. Don't tie it too loose. You don't need a bunch of extra wire past the clevises. But, you know, when I'm building them in the boat, guess what I do? All right, there's my skirt. Stack of freaking enough. All right, I got two fingers. I got a finger above the skirt. All right. Put the lure buddy on. A couple more beads, clevises. All right, one finger length above the clevis. And, you know, doing this with a pair of vice grips and just bush fixing, bush making bucktail. So, you know, just create that separation. Don't tie everything so tight. There shouldn't be rigidity. You know, nothing is compressed. Yeah. Everything's loose and can flow and spacing. That's all that matters on bucktails. Other thing about
the more spacing, the more open wire too, the more vibration you're going to get out of the whole bait. It'll shake more so that you can go overboard with that. You can experiment with that too. The lighter the wire, the more vibration.
Yep.
The lighter the blade type, the easier it's going to trip.
Yep. I'm trying to think of other mistakes. Unevenness and weighting to an extreme, right? Whether it be like Steph Herbie notoriously will tie really heavy bucktails, right? Like 1.5 ounce egg sinkers, 2 ounce egg sinkers, right? You can't have some number 6 Indiana blades on the front of that, right? So we need a balance between the weight, and we need a balance between the lift. So your weight can't be so heavy that the lift can't kind of get that thing running. I love bucktails that run it like an angle, right? Really heavy bucktails that kind of run weird in deep, clear water. But there's a balancing act between that, right? But be cognizant. You can't, you know, don't start off with the wrong blades. You need, if you're going to have a heavy weighted bucktail, often you need large blades, 9s, 10s to offset that. So you've not created a vertical jig. You've made something that'll run on a linear plane somewhat flatly, right? So don't go over the top with your weighting, whether that be in the front or the back, right? Go for if you start building bucktails, go for like evenness is quite important most of the time, right? So if we have, I don't know what they make, Jay, was it a 3/4 ounce lure body, I believe? Something we have common, right? So you'll have like a 3/4 ounce lure body. Put a 3/4 ounce. It's like 3/4 ounce.
They don't really list the weight. Half ounce is real common. I don't know about 3/4.
I'm sure if half is common, then there's 3/4, and I doubt there's an ounce. I know there's like two common sizes, which is probably 1/2 ounce and 3/4, I'm guessing. Allow me the latitude, because the reason I say that, you have readily available egg sinkers of those sizes, right? So if you're doing 1/2 ounce, now can you use 1/2 ounce lure body and a 3/4 ounce egg sinker? Absolutely. But don't go 1/2 ounce lure body, 2 ounce egg sinker, right? So you got a little bit of play there. Go for evenness. The cool thing about bucktails, and heck, we're talking about the book, but man, there's a cool section, at least I hope people think it's cool, where I'm breaking down all the lure classes. and I've made recommendations about, you know, here's my personal favorites, like it or lump it. It's just like listening to the podcast. You know what? If I pick my three favorite Twitch baits, or I pick, you know, just kind of putting it there. And when I did Bucktails, it's the oddball, because I said I don't have a favorite. You need to make them. And I think it's so liberating. You know, Bucktails companies hate this one trick, Jay. Click now, right? You know? It's liberating as a tackle nut to just not care what Bucktail they came out with. Oh, you've got double... whatever, I'm not going to pick on any. We've got a number 2 fluted and a number 12. I'm trying to come up. Don't ever make that. It's the worst combination I could think of, but nobody's made it. Therefore, I can pick at something. Let's say a company comes out with a number 2 French blade paired with a number 12 Colorado, right, Jay? And sure. It's the new squirrely, McGurley, musky catcher machine. That's their cool name. A lot of show collars on it, right? They got tons of show collars for you. So the Squirrely McGurley here, whatever the hell it is, well, all I need to do is see a picture. Oh, it's 11 inches long. It has that blade combination. It weighs 1.5 ounces. Okay. Let me go make one. Right? Pretty simple. It's pretty liberating when you go, oh, that's working on this body of water, right? They're catching muskies on an 8-9 stagger configuration. I'm hearing, you know, you're hearing good reports about so-and-so lake, you know, over on Succotoban, they're just blasting them on black, pink, 7-8 staggers. You go to your parts box, you make yourself a black, pink, 7-8 stagger, and you're good to go. And then you can augment it on the fly on the water. You know, you can, it really eliminates a lot of, cover your ears, Jay, just hum for a second. Eliminates having to buy a bunch of baits, where you can focus on hard baits. You can focus on rubber and baits that are disposable. We need to treat bucktails as a class of parts and pieces rather than pre-made lures. It's liberating, because you go, oh, cool, great. They're on X, Y, and Z, got that. And a guy really only needs a couple of each blade. Okay, I got four. I would have like 4 Colorados, 4 Indianas of varying sizes. And I would guarantee you, Jay, what would you think? Just, man, people, again, not a Bucktail maker's favorite subject, but okay, to hit every combination that I'm aware of in Bucktails that's popular and have a smattering that I can make and cut and break up on any given day, $60. What do you think?
Well, sure, you get a lot of gear for $60. That's a lot of beads, bodies, pieces of wire, clevises, blades.
Okay, I need
some treble hooks and skirts. It does add up, but it's just like
rabbit hole. If we're rambling, we're rambling, right? Let me go here. Where is this at? This is the stuff they tune in for, Jay. Old man yells about bucktails. So, hold on. Let's look here. For a seven inch pre-tud skirts, 2 of those will make you a freaking double 10 or a single, right? $6. So you could have black, purple, a light color, and like a natural thing. So you need 4 of those, like 20. Okay. So you got like $20 there. Then you get a clevises. Oh, a bag of clevises are $2.99. Watch your pocketbooks, right?
Yeah, make 2 dozen bucktails with that bag. Yeah.
Well, if you keep cutting them up, you can make them forever. You don't even need... the fun thing is this. You don't even have to have split rings. Just put the hook on there and build from there, because you're going to cut it up. Or, you know, okay, your bag of split rings, $7. Okay, so 20, 22, call it 30 beads. $1.60 a 10 pack. And you don't need to stagger them. That's one thing. That's like a bucktail myth. When you buy a production bucktail, you'll see a really nice staggering of the beads. Muskies don't care, Jay. They don't care. So I usually in my box, I'll have large beads and small beads, and I'll just kind of build it accordingly. Something that's a trick, and it's a space filler. So you don't have to use a ton of beads like up under the skirt, because you always put your skirting material on, and then you have to put the weight on, and then you have to get down to where you're going to have the loop for the hook, right?
Yeah, you want light. Yeah, you want a light built bucktail right. too. There's hollow beads too, hollow which beads. Virtually have no weight, so that's your spacing effect right there.
Yeah, peeler beads from Hobby Lobby. You can buy 1,000 for like $3. They're just little plastic circle. You know what I'm talking about? You make arts and crafts with them.
I don't, but yeah, apparently you do.
I do all day long. That's what, it's a little secret squirrel thing. That's what I use too to put my trailer hooks on for spinnerbaits or peeler beads. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's a trick I stole from Don James over at Figure Eight. That's what he's been using for years. And they're super easy to work with. You just slide them on and they are high density plastic and they ain't going to break. And you can use them for spacers on your bucktails. So sure. I would say, I mean, realistically, you get in the blades, a couple bucks here, a couple there. There's no way. I mean, you could easily for $60, maybe even $50, have a serviceable, complete bucktail collection for just about any scenario in one Plano box. Now, you're going to have to make them, right? Hey, I tried double eights this morning. Let me tie up a single seven. You know what I'm saying? But you have a box of versatility right then and there, which is just, like I said, super liberating. Jay likes to tie deer hair, though, in his boat. It's kind of messy.
Dense stuff.
Just an entire...
Repels water.
You drive around with a pelt and some scissors. They call him the pelt man of the Wisconsin River. Just
Casey, hey, don't joke. Casey from work, from the Muskie Shop.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he gets into that beavers. Beavers. Yeah, he's gotten some big ones. He'll trap. He'll shoot anything. Oh, wow. Duck hunter. The kid.
Casey,
the wilderness machine.
Casey,
yep. You
got
want beaver fur? He's got them.
Casey got some beavers.
Yeah.
Wow. Have you guys heard of Xbox up there yet? I'm gonna mail that kid an Xbox 360 and watch his head explode, Jay. Anyway, that'll do it, folks. Say goodnight, Jay.
Yeah, just remember, Steve's new book called Addressing the Gerbil in the Room by Stephen Spall is coming out soon at a local dealer near you. Thanks for tuning in and bye-bye now.
Addressing the Gerbil is good shit. Later.
So